This is London calling. We take you now to the Guildhall for the speech by the Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Neville Chamberlain, at the Lord Mayor's banquet.
At this moment, the Lord Mayor of London, Sir Frank Bogwater, should be proposing the health of His Majesty's ministers. We are taking you now to Guildhall to hear the end of the Lord Mayor's speech and the reply by the Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Neville Chamberlain.
Let us therefore hope that the expression of mutual confidence and goodwill exchanged between the Prime Minister and the German Chancellor, which so truly reflects the feelings of the people of our two countries, will pave the way to a speedy and peaceful solution of all the differences which divide us at the present time. Ladies and gentlemen, you will not expect me, in the short time at my disposal tonight, to refer to the many and complex problems with which His Majesty's ministers have had to deal during the past civic year. It has been a period of intense anxiety, and we owe them a deep debt of gratitude for their services. I should not do justice to this toast without paying a personal tribute to the Prime Minister. One of his predecessors spoke of the intolerable burden of his office. That description of the office of Prime Minister is true even in normal times. But throughout the crisis from which we have so recently emerged, the strain which the Prime Minister had to bear must have been almost beyond human endurance. I say without hesitation that he has served and deserved the confidence and esteem not only of the people of this country, but of the whole world. Mr. Prime Minister, we thank you and your colleagues for having honored us with your presence here tonight. Perhaps it is not inappropriate that your first appearance at a public function since your great achievement should be in the capital city of the Empire. I am proud to be permitted to couple your name with this toast and to know that your reply delivered in this ancient hall will be heard in the homes of the English-speaking peoples throughout the world. Your Excellencies, Your Grace, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, I give you with great cordiality the toast of His Majesty's ministers, and I couple with it the name of the Right Honourable Neville Chamberlain, Prime Minister.
The toast is His Majesty's ministers, coupled with the name of the Right Honourable Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister. Neville Chamberlain, Member of Parliament, the Prime Minister.
My Lord Mayor, Your Excellencies, Your Grace, my lords and gentlemen, and ladies and gentlemen. You, my Lord Mayor, with that courtesy which is traditional among the holders of your great office, I propose the health of His Majesty's ministers in terms which are all the more gratifying to our ears because they form a marked contrast to the valuation which has been put upon our services by some less partial observers. It's not for me to say which is the truer estimate, but I may at least thank you, my Lord Mayor, for the discrimination with which you have dwelt upon our achievements and passed over our shortcomings, if we have any. And I must express my unqualified gratitude to this company for the magnificent reception which they have given to the tourist. I recognized in that demonstration just now a more than usual warmth and enthusiasm. And I think I know what it meant. For it expressed a spirit which has been manifested throughout the many thousands of letters which I have received during recent weeks. Spirit of England, thankful to have been spared the ordeal which came so close, but ready now to answer any call which their country may make upon them in order that she may face the future with equanimity. My Lord Mayor, it is customary on these occasions for the Prime Minister to present a general review of foreign affairs. But I hope I shall not be thought discourteous to any nation or unmindful of those with whom we have specially friendly relations if tonight I depart from this practice and confine myself to a strictly limited field. For unless I did that, I should be unable to deal as I should wish with a subject which is uppermost in the minds of most of us, and perhaps of those who are listening to me in different parts of the world. I mean the significance of the events which culminated at Munich. Now, I am speaking tonight to an audience vastly greater than that which I see in front of me. There will be many among them who have approved what I have been trying to do. There will be many who think I ought to have done something quite different. There will be many who think that they had sufficient knowledge to form a sound and considered judgment upon these events. But I think probably the great majority do not fully understand the situation and would welcome a little guidance because they feel that what has happened and still more what is going to happen must vitally affect their interests and that of the generations which are going to come after them. And it is to those people in particular that I want to speak tonight. And since, as I'm not infrequently reminded, I am no orator, I shall use such plain and simple language as I can command. First of all, I would like to get rid of the idea that at Munich there was a clash between different systems of government, and that the result was a victory for one side or the other. Now, of course, you always get enthusiasts who are more royalist than the king and who make claims which are in no way sponsored by their own leaders. They're like the claims which are put forward in wartime, when, as you may read any day now in our newspapers, both sides declare that in the same action they inflicted a crushing defeat upon their adversaries. By a curious perversion, sometimes we get an equally extravagant claim that it was the speaker's own side that suffered defeat and humiliation. I confess that for my part, I don't understand a state of mind which desires to advertise the defeat of its own country. But at any rate, I, who happened to be there, can tell you that at Munich there was no clash and there was no question of victory or defeat for either side. And I think if we are wise, we shall find that one of the most gratifying features about Munich was that it was demonstrated there that four great powers owning different systems of government were able to sit down together and agree without quarreling upon the main outlines of a settlement of one of the most thorny and dangerous international problems of our time. They were able to do that. Doesn't it encourage us to think that it must be possible for such powers to agree on other things as well? Yeah. To agree not only on preventing disasters, but on creating happiness and prosperity for all their peoples by mutual aid. For every leader in every country, whatever may be his political creed, must surely put as the first of his aims the improvement of the lot of his fellow creatures. In such meetings, personal contacts are made which may prove of the greatest value. In the days before the date at which most of our modern history books begin, it was possible for a nation to live in isolation and to develop its civilization without interference from outside. But today, we must all of us take account of our neighbors. And unless we can learn to live with them, unless we can find some understanding of their ways of thought, we shall never make real progress or secure stability for ourselves. For my part, I prefer our British political system with the wide extent of freedom which it gives to the individual. I prefer that to any form of government which subjects the will of the individual completely to the authority of the state. Which means, of course, to the authority of those who for the time being represent the state. But it does seem to me entirely contrary to the spirit of democracy to attempt to deny to any other nation the right to adopt any form of government that they may prefer. And it seems to me all the more inappropriate to do so, because history shows us that forms of government do not remain unchanged. Alterations, modifications, even reversals have taken place in every generation in some country or another, and there is no reason to suppose that even today any of us have reached a final and unalterable stage. Now, my Lord Mayor, after those preliminary observations, I would like to turn to the policy, the foreign policy of His Majesty's government. And I shall make no apology for repeating things that have often been said before, because there are some people who persist in saying that they have never been told what the foreign policy of the government is. In the first speech that I made after I became Prime Minister, I summed up the aims of His Majesty's government under four heads. The first was to maintain peace. The second, to make this country so strong that she should be treated everywhere with respect. The third was to promote the prosperity of industry and thus provide employment for our people. And the fourth was to work steadily for the improvement of the conditions of the people. Ladies and gentlemen, those still remain the aims of the government. And the policy of the government must be adapted from time to time to existing conditions in order to achieve them. I can only deal tonight with the first two. But I might say in passing that they are essential to the others. We shall secure neither prosperity nor welfare unless we have peace and the strength to maintain it. I want to emphasize this point. To lay down an aim is one thing. To achieve it is something quite different. And if you want peace, you've got to do something more than sit down and hope for it. The Americans have an expression, doubtless you're familiar with it, which, as American terms so often do, conveys its meaning without explanation. They talk of a go-getter. Well, I want this government to be a go-getter for peace. That doesn't mean that we want to go and interfere with other people's business or to undertake the role of policemen in ordinary to the world. But if we see peace threatened, we shall use any influence that we may possess to save it. And if war breaks out, we shall take any opportunity that we can see to stop it. For in these days, it is difficult to confine war to the source of its origin. And once it begins to spread, it is harder still to control its boundaries. And I feel all the more convinced of the soundness of this policy because I believe that the influence which this country can exert for peace is more powerful than that of any other that I can think of. It arises partly from our geographical position, lying a little apart from Europe, partly from our widespread connections through the empire with the whole world, partly, no doubt, from the vastness of the resources at our disposal, but above all, because there is a general recognition that fundamentally what we are seeking is peace, security, and justice for all under the rule of law and order, reason and good faith. It is with these considerations in mind that I have sought to make this country an active agent for peace. And I would like now to turn to the example of that policy in practice, which has lately been engaging our attention. This is not the place, and I have not the time, to recite the whole history of the Czechoslovakian question. But in order that I may illustrate to you the methods by which our foreign policy has been carried on, I must first of all go back to the time when, realizing the grave results that might follow upon the continuance of friction and discord, we used our persuasive powers with the two parties in Czechoslovakia in the hope of inducing them to settle their differences. When that failed, still pursuing our policy of conciliation, we suggested to them that they should make use of the services of Lord Runciman as mediator. And since then, and thereafter, Lord Runciman devoted all his time and his great gifts to the task of bringing the two parties together. No doubt you recollect the incidents which brought Lord Runciman's mission to a standstill. From that moment, the situation became one of increasing gravity until at last, not only His Majesty's government, but all the peoples of the world found themselves on the very brink of the abyss. Well, it's needless to relate now the steps that were taken, even at the 11th hour, to avert disaster. But what I want to stress to you is this: peace was not saved by words, not even by notes. It was saved by action. Now that the crisis is over, it is very easy to find fault with a solution. But the fact is that in the situation with which we had to deal, it was not possible to present the ideal solution as the alternative to force. We were dealing with a situation which had arisen from forces which had been set in motion nearly 20 years before. And the surgeon who has to deal with long neglected wounds or disease must cut more swiftly and more deeply than he who is operating on the first symptoms. And if the settlement at Munich imposed upon Czechoslovakia a fate which arouses our natural sympathy for a small state and for a proud and brave people, yet we cannot dismiss in silence the thought of what the alternative would have meant to the peoples, not only of Czechoslovakia, but of all the nations that would have been involved. Ladies and gentlemen, I have no shadow of doubt in my mind that what we did was right. That in doing it, we have earned the gratitude of the vast majority in Europe and even in the world. But now you would make a great mistake if you thought that Munich began and ended with the settlement of the Czechoslovakian question. On the day after the conference was ended, I had a long conversation with the German Chancellor, at the close of which we issued a joint declaration. And I should like, with your permission, to read to you the three paragraphs of which it was composed, because it does not seem to me that even now they have received sufficient attention. And I may say that although the Munich settlement has been freely criticized, I think it would be very difficult for even the most determined war at any price man to find much fault with the paragraphs which I'm going to recall to your memory. In the first one, we agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. I don't think anybody would deny that. The second one expresses an opinion, namely that we regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again. And again I ask, can anybody, knowing the feeling here and knowing the feeling of the people in Germany, can anybody doubt that those words express the heartfelt desire of the two peoples? Then I come to the third paragraph. We are resolved that the method of consultation shall be the method adopted to deal with any other questions that may concern our two countries. And we are determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of difference and thus to contribute to assure the peace of Europe. Is anybody going to condemn that statement of policy? And yet there are some minds so saturated with suspicion that they see even in such a blameless document as that some loosening of our ties with France. What a fatuous proposition. Based on the false assumption that Europe must forever be ranged in two opposing blocks and that it is impossible to make friends with one without becoming the enemy of the other. Ladies and gentlemen, our relations with France are too long-standing, too intimate, too highly prized by both of us to allow such suspicions to be entertained for one moment. And it is with the utmost pleasure that Lord Halifax and I are looking forward to the visit which we shall shortly be paying, accompanied by our respected ladies, to Paris in response to the cordial invitation of the French government. There was just one other matter which I should like to mention before passing from the subject, because if not the result of Munich, it certainly is connected with it. As part of this active policy of peacemaking, which involves searching out and removing causes of suspicion and antagonism wherever they may exist, I attempted, soon after I became Prime Minister, to improve our relations with Italy. And last April, we were able to make an agreement with the Italian government. Although that agreement did not immediately come into full operation, yet it was at once followed by a return of the old feelings of cordiality and friendship between our two peoples. And subsequently, this change for the better had the happiest result in enlisting the powerful aid of Signor Mussolini for a peaceful solution of the Czechoslovakian question. And now, since we need no longer regard the Spanish conflict as a menace to the peace of Europe, that agreement will soon be coming into force, and I am confident that it will be found to be a further advance towards that general appeasement of Europe at which we are aiming. My Lord Mayor, to some people, this policy of conciliation and appeasement, which I have been describing, may seem to forbid that at the same time we should be completing and even accelerating the program of rearmament to which we are simultaneously devoting ourselves. But there is really no inconsistency between the two. Ultimately, if we can get rid of suspicions, and if we can enter upon a new era of confidence, we shall all be ready to disarm together. And the sooner that time comes, the better. But meantime, we should not be serving the cause of peace by unilateral disarmament. On the contrary, we must maintain our forces at a level commensurate with our responsibilities and with the part we want to play in maintaining peace. The British Commonwealth of Nations has traditions of freedom which make it a steadying factor in a world which has not yet regained its former stability. We in this country are vitally interested in preserving it, and we must be ready to play our part in its military protection. And that is a fact which always comes to the front in the reviews which are made from time to time of our defense requirements by our service advisors. I've myself, for a number of years, been concerned, directly or indirectly, in those reviews, and I cannot remember any paper of major importance coming to us from the chiefs of staff which did not direct our attention to our overseas commitments and to our responsibility for helping to defend this or that part of the empire. Therefore, when we speak of our defense forces and say that they must be adequate, it is upon that word defense that we lay our stress. We do not need to build armaments in order to take from anybody else anything that they now have. But we should be failing in our duty to our own people if we were to leave them without the means of resisting aggression from any nation less peacefully disposed than our own. And I would venture to add this, that it is the man who is conscious of his own weakness who can least afford to be generous in his dealings with others. Because he will always recoil from yielding to the claims of justice, lest his action should be attributed to his fear of the consequences of resistance. Now, it was inevitable that an experience such as that which we have lately passed through should reveal shortcomings in our defensive system. Such defects, depend upon it, exist in the defensive system of every country, although they are not always advertised as publicly as they are here. But it would be a profound error to think that if war had not come, we should not have given a good account of ourselves. Our task now is to remedy those defects. And the further measures which we think necessary will in due course be laid before Parliament in its main outlines, if not in all the details. And if that should entail further efforts and further sacrifices upon the nation, I have no doubt of the willingness of the nation to undertake them, whether they be in service or in money. I hope it is unnecessary for me to repeat here what I have said on other occasions, that the whole business of piling up armaments is utterly distasteful to me. Seems to me the height of human folly to be thus dissipating resources which could and should be used for the purpose, for purposes conducive to the health and to the happiness of mankind. But for the time being, I regard it as an inevitable, but I hope only a temporary accompaniment of that other part of the policy to which I can turn all my energies without qualification and without misgiving. The policy of understanding and goodwill, a policy which is desired by all the peoples, the policy to which I invite the cooperation of all the nations. My Lord Mayor, the aims that I have described are not to be achieved in a few months. They require untiring patience, prolonged effort in the face of misunderstanding, of criticism, of disappointment. They require the vision to seize every opportunity as it comes. But it is an end which is worthy to inspire that spirit of England of which I spoke earlier in the evening. For it alone can save the generation which is coming from the nightmare that has hung over us so long. And now, my Lord Mayor, just one last word. Christmas is coming. and I see no reason why we should not prepare ourselves for the festive season in a spirit of cheerfulness and confidence. You hear, in this great center of trade and commerce, are accustomed to watch very closely the signs of the times. I have no doubt that you have noted those favorable features to which I directed the attention of the House of Commons yesterday. The improvement in employment in this country, the check in the downward trend of commodity prices, the healthier condition of business in the United States, where transactions are on such a vast scale that they must always exercise a powerful influence on the world. And I would add to that one other consideration, perhaps more important than all, and it is that in my judgment, after the disturbances in September, political conditions in Europe are now settling down to quieter times. Therefore, I say, in this brightening atmosphere, let us not conjure up troubles which may never arise, but rather set about our several tasks with a determination that the new year should be more prosperous and happier than the old.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to an address by Neville Chamberlain, Prime Minister of England, broadcast via radio from the Lord Mayor's banquet in London, England. This special shortwave broadcast was heard in America via RCA Communications through the cooperation of the British Broadcasting Corporation, and this is the National Broadcasting Company.